I am Valentin Fusters for Jack, issue of September the 24th of 2019. This week in Jack, we have an interesting focus seminar on progress in the understanding and management of cardiovascular disease. And we have chosen four topics. The first, from detecting the vulnerable plaque to managing the vulnerable patient. The second, from focal lipid storage to systemic inflammation. The third topic, from subclinical atherosclerosis to plaque progression and acute coronary events. And the final topic, from early pharmacology to recent pharmacology interventions in acute coronary syndromes. It's like an historical approach of how these four topics have evolved over the years, and certainly with a present update. Let's focus on topic number four, entitled From Early Pharmacology to Recent Pharmacology Interventions in Acute Coronary Syndromes. The first author of this outstanding and encyclopedic document is Dr. Carolina Zumer, from the Section of Cardiology, Department of Medicine at the Karolinska Institute, Karolinska University Hospital in Sweden. The last and corresponding author is Dr. Lars Wallentine from the Uppsala Clinical Research Center and Department of Medical Sciences at Uppsala University in Sweden. A third author is Dr. Thomas Jernberg from the Department of Clinical Sciences at the Danderyd University Hospital, Karolinska Institute, also in Stockholm, Sweden. After a brief introduction, I'm going to be addressing four different sections. In talking about acute coronary syndromes, let's in section number one address the progress unrelated to antithrombotic therapy. Section number two, about the progress related to antithrombotic therapy. Section number three, other pharmacological agents that actually play a role in the decrease of mortality following myocardial infarction. Angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibition, mineralocorticoid antagonists, and statins. And section number four is entitled From Clinical Trials to Implementation in the Healthcare System. Before addressing these four sections, let me introduce the subject. I think we all agree that during the last three decades, the development of treatment in acute myocardial infarction management has been remarkable. For example, in the 1950s and 1960s, a heart attack was associated with an in-hospital mortality of up to 30%. Today, the in-hospital mortality is about 3 to 8%. In addition, one-year mortality declined from 22% in 1995 to around 11% by 2014. How this all happened? This is the objective of this excellent paper that we publish in JACC today. Let me start light rather than heavy. When we talk about myocardial infarction, in the 1960s and 1970s, there was a full agreement that a thrombotic occlusion of the coronary arteries was part of the myocardial infarction. But it was debatable whether the blood clot was the cause or the consequence of the infarct. Was in the 1970s and 1980s that it became clear that the thrombotic occlusion in STEMI is the cause of the myocardial infarction. But just to be clear from the beginning, we have three types of syndromes which set up the context of the paper today in JACC. The first syndrome is of course STEMI. The second syndrome is an unstable angina and non-STEMI. And the third syndrome being approached is an acute coronary syndrome. which may be related to STEMI or to an unstable angina in non-STEMI. With these rather light comments, let me now go section after section why there was so much progress in the decline of mortality from myocardial infarction if we go back to the 1960s from then to today. Here we have section number one, progress related to non-antithrombotic agents. Five aspects of progress are being discussed. First, from bed rest to treatment. Second, beta blockers in myocardial infarction. Third, reperfusion therapy. Fourth, opening the coronary arteries and keeping them open in STEMI by primary PCI. And fifth, early revascularization in unstable angina and non-STEMI. So here's the first issue of progress. We have to go back to the 1960s. Until then, the main therapy for acute myocardial infarction was prolonged bed rest and reduction of excessive physical activity. Actually, bed rest could take place in the hospital for 4 to 6 weeks. It was in the early 1960s that the first coronary care units were established. Patients were then continuously monitored, patients with acute myocardial infarction, allowing cardiac arrhythmias to be promptly identified and treated, and certainly ventricular fibrillation being addressed with defibrillation. The reduction in mortality with the coronary care units was very significant, from around 30% to 15%. I am proud to say that I work in the first, or one of the first coronary care units with Dr. Desmond Julian. I was his fellow, and he certainly is the father of the coronary care units. I still remember using lidocaine for the first time. In terms of bed rest in discharge from the hospital, there was a big change. With the coronary care units, patients stayed in those units for about a couple of days, and in the hospital, about 1 week to 10 days, a significant change as compared before the 1960s. Now, a second piece of progress in the 1970s, beta blockers. When I was working in the coronary care unit at the University of Edinburgh, Royal Infirmary, the word beta blocker didn't sound good because we were trying to avoid hypotension as well as arrhythmias. However, beta blockers began to work well in patients with angina, certainly from the symptomatology point of view. And this led in the 1970s, the beginning of use of beta blockers following acute myocardial infarction, but without cardiac failure. It was at the turn of the century that beta blockers were began to be strongly indicated in patients with acute myocardial infarction, particularly those who had a trend towards cardiac failure. And the results, according to the original trials, were quite supportive of such beta blockade in this type of patients. Well, then we enter the era of reperfusion in STEMI. The first few studies published at the end of 1970s, early 1980s, but was the GC trial in the ICES-2 trial that verified the possibility that the streptokinase could significantly decrease mortality in patients with STEMI. The GASTO trial pointed out that perhaps tissue plasminogen activator was of more benefit than streptokinase. However, in my view, the main advance made by GASTO is muscle is time, clearly pointing out that earlier was the reperfusion of patients with myocardial infarction, smaller was the infarct size and better the outcomes. So with all these excitements, something important happened. And this is the fourth issue of progress. the PAMI study was a breakthrough. It showed that angioplasty in patients with acute myocardial infarction could open arteries, and the results perhaps could be better than with the use of thrombolytic therapy. Subsequently, in the late 1980s, stenting began to be implanted in patients with acute myocardial infarction, and such mechanical approach, up until today, is the standard of care. At this junction, I want to make 2 points. The first is that the use of thrombolytic therapy, specifically streptokinase, was done intracoronary, and Peter Rentrup was one of the protagonists. Was later on, with the GC and the ICIS-2 trial, that the thrombolytic therapy was given intravenously, and so subsequently TPA. And this leads to the second point. Not all communities have hospitals or centers in which such intervention with stenting is possible. And was then, at the turn of the century, that the Dynamy 2 study, or registry from the Danish groups, took the forefront of the management of myocardial infarction at that time. 3 types of therapy. First, the patient could reach an institution or a center without the capability of mechanically opening the coronary arteries, so thrombolytic therapy was an option. The second approach is once the diagnosis of myocardial infarction was made in one of these centers, to transfer rapidly the patient into a center that had the capabilities for opening the coronary artery with mechanical means, as I mentioned. And the third approach is the patient being nearby a center for capabilities for mechanically opening the coronary arteries, just get there as quickly as possible. It turns out that a week ago in Paris, at the time of the European Society of Cardiology, data was presented to us about such modes of therapy in the Dynamy 2 study with a 15-year follow-up. And frankly, the results were very good for the different approaches. Taking into account the composite endpoint of death or rehospitalization for myocardial infarction, at 15 years of follow-up, PCI-treated patients had a sustained lower rate of composite endpoint, 58% versus 62% in the lytic therapy group. So the results were good and not so different, telling us that at least in Denmark, there is an excellent system with access to patients who may be far from centers that can perform PCI in a given time, but with the capabilities to either undertake fibrinolytic therapy or to transfer the patients rapidly into such centers. And this leads to the fifth aspect of progress thus far, including antithrombotic therapy approaches. And this is early revascularization in an unstable angina and non-STEMI. Based on the FRISC-2 study, the TACTIS-TIMI-18 study, and the RITA-3 study, we can conclude that based on these studies, an early invasive treatment became the preferred approach in intermediate to high-risk patients with unstable angina or non-STEMI. Such decision of whether the patient has moderate or high risk is based on the clinical presentation, the electrocardiogram, and troponin levels. Indeed, some of these patients actually can have a mild risk and be treated conservatively, while the majority have an invasive approach within the early hours of days of admission into the hospital. And then the decision about intervention has to be made. So we finish section number 1, progress unrelated to antithrombotic therapy, and we mention five facts that led to the decrease in mortality following myocardial infarction. Now we have section number two, how antithrombotic therapy has contributed to the decrease in mortality following myocardial infarction. Certainly it has contributed, but the subject is quite complex, you will understand. First, we are dealing with three different syndromes and different approaches in terms of intervention. We are dealing with a STEMI, and the intervention may be with lytic therapy or with PCI. We are dealing with non-STEMI, and the intervention can take place in those patients with mid or high risk, but not in those with mild risk. And then we have a mixture of acute coronary syndromes in which antithrombotic therapy has been used in both simultaneously in the same trial, for STEMI and for non-STEMI. Now, let's add to the complexity. We have in this section number 2, 10 different antithrombotic approaches. For each of the variables that we mentioned in terms of the syndromes and whether or not the patients are being intervened. I just counted and we are dealing with about 100 variables. Let me try to summarize what we know today following the script of this document on one after the other of the antithrombotic approaches, when to use them, when not to use them. In the first three approaches, we are talking about platelet inhibition. Approaches 4 to 8, we are talking about anticoagulants intravenously given or subcutaneously, with some of the agents having both anticoagulant properties and antiplatelet properties. And finally, approach number 9 and 10, we are talking about oral anticoagulants, either with conventional warfarin or with NOACs. So let's review one by one all these 10 approaches. First, aspirin. As you know, inhibits thromboxane A2-mediated platelet aggregation. And low doses of aspirin, like 50 to 100 milligrams daily, might provide the same antithrombotic effects as tested at a higher doses, and certainly with a lower incidence of bleeding. Just summarizing, in the 1980s, the meta-analysis of the aspirin trials clearly showed that aspirin treatment reduced vascular mortality by 15% and new myocardial infarction and stroke by 30% in patients with any type of vascular diseases, regardless of dose. In unstable angina and non-STEMI, there were three pioneering studies: the VA Cooperative Study, the Canadian Study, and the RISC Study. A pioneering study in STEMI was the ICES-2 trial. And the pioneering study in using aspirin in CABG, I believe, was ours, that we published with Dr. James Chisborough, then at the Mayo Clinic. Again, aspirin for all vascular diseases. Strategy number 2, DAPT or dual antiplatelet therapy. The principle is that an unstable coronary artery disease, such as acute coronary syndromes, is being seen in the context of higher thrombogenicity than patients with chronic disease. And such thrombogenicity is particularly active when the coronary artery is being approached by intervention. So in the era of intervention, it was considered that to aspirin, another platelet inhibitor should be added. And the choice were agents that effectively inhibit the P2Y12 receptor of the platelet. First, ticlopidine failed because of the risk of bone marrow suppression. Then clopidogrel evolved, with the CURE trial in patients with unstable angina and non-STEMI, and with the Clarity TIMI 28 and COMMIT trials in patients with STEMI. Just for the record, in the CURE trial, the abundance of patients treated with unstable angina and non-STEMI were conservatively approached without intervention. And in the STEMI groups of the Clarity TIMI 28 and COMMIT, the patients were treated with fibrinolytic therapy. Thus far, that's good for the use of clopidogrel. It became clear, however, that in patients with the STEMI and treated with stenting, as well as those patients with unstable angina and non-STEMI, also treated with stenting, ticagrelor or prasugrel were more effective than clopidogrel. We are particularly talking about the Plateau study and the Pegasus study. So in acute coronary syndromes, and based on this data, dual antiplatelet therapy, preferably with ticagrelor, for at least 1 and eventually up to 2 years, is now the recommended treatment in patients with non-STEMI and STEMI. Here again, and based in the presentations at the European Society of Cardiology in Paris a week ago, the status of prasugrel as a protagonist together with ticagrelor appears at the present time rapidly evolving. And this leads to antithrombotic approach number 3. Here we are talking with a P2Y12 inhibitor given intravenously, cangrelor. The action in the P2Y12 receptor is reversible and has an immediate onset and offset, so the drug is easily controllable. Currently, its main use is in invasively treated patients with acute coronary syndromes who are unable to take oral more potent P2Y12 inhibitors. So summarizing these 3 approaches, first aspirin for all, second ticagrelor, and perhaps prasugrel added to aspirin in the acute coronary syndromes, and third cangrelor intravenously when such oral agents cannot be used. Before I move into the anticoagulants, I would like to make one point for the record. The effectiveness of ticagrelor and prasugrel in comparison with clopidogrel in patients with acute coronary syndromes is not because these 2 drugs are more active and therefore more susceptible to bleeding too, but their benefit is because also in about 30% of patients taking clopidogrel, the inactive drug cannot be activated in the liver with the appropriate enzymes. Aspect that may be a problem in a patient with an acute coronary syndrome, and perhaps less obvious in patients with chronic disease. So let's now move into issues of progress because of antithrombotic therapy. 5 of them, from number 4 to number 8, most of them with anticoagulant properties and maybe some platelet inhibitor properties too, some given intravenously, some subcutaneously, and some orally. So here we have antithrombotic strategy number 4, unfractionated heparin. Such heparin inhibits thrombin and activated factor 10A. In fact, heparin is the most widely used anticoagulant in patients with acute coronary syndromes, whether it's STEMI with fibrinolytic therapy or with PCI, or whether it's a patient with unstable angina or non-STEMI. In this second group, with non-STEMI or unstable angina, particularly those who are intervened. Just to say that the intravenous approach of unfractionated heparin tends to be short, no more than 48 hours, since the long-term approach is cumbersome. because it requires monitoring. Strategy number 5. Subcutaneous low molecular weight heparin. At least 10 studies are being quoted in the document presented today in JAG. In most of them, the approach with such subcutaneous heparin is in about 3 to 8 days. Since given for a longer period of time, appears not to lead to benefit and perhaps concerns with bleeding. Overall, in the 10 studies presented, some with an unstable angina or non-STEMI and others with a STEMI, based on these experiences, intravenous heparin or subcutaneous low molecular weight heparin are recommended only for a short-term use while awaiting and during invasive coronary procedures during hospital stay in patients with an unstable angina again, as well as in a STEMI. Now strategy number 6, fondaparinol. It provides a specific antithrombin-mediated inhibition of only factor 10A. Is a reasonable antithrombotic agent, not affected by much bleeding. It serves as a backup to low molecular weight heparin. Certainly is an alternative, but there is a concern. Catheter-related thrombosis when the drug is being used. The addition of intravenous heparin at the time of intervention solves the problem. And here is alternative number 7. We did not forget about bilirubin. The controversy continues of whether such drug is more or less effective than heparin, intravenous heparin, or causes more or less bleeding. However, two things can be said. One is that bilirubin should never be used in association with glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors or with heparin. And second, cost is significantly higher than heparin. Let me add one point to this discussion. You might say, my patient is admitted to the hospital with an acute coronary syndrome, and therefore he's given aspirin and he's given ticagrelor or prasugrel. It is justified to use heparin, intravenous heparin, or intravenous bilirubin. It is justified, but again, both drugs given through a very short period of time. Although bilirubin can be considered an anticoagulant since it has a direct thrombin inhibitor effect, the next approach with glycoprotein 2B3A inhibition, we are rather talking again about a platelet inhibitor effect, since these agents inhibit the binding of fibrinogen to GP2B3A in the activation of the platelet. These drugs are very effective in the thrombotic phenomena, but unfortunately they have been associated with an increased bleeding risk and thrombocytopenia. Based in 7 studies, well documented in the paper published today in JAG, the use of glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors has been associated with an increased bleeding risk and thrombocytopenia that led to its use to be only infrequent at this time. Just only focus on those patients with no reflow or remaining thrombus. Two approaches, antithrombotic approaches, have not been discussed. Approach number 9, with oral anticoagulation, and we are talking about vitamin K antagonists. In approach number 10, the new oral anticoagulants. What do we have to say of these agents in the acute coronary syndromes? In regard to oral anticoagulation with vitamin K antagonists, the key trial was the WARIS 2 trial. When warfarin alone combined with aspirin or aspirin alone were tested for 4 years after an acute myocardial infarction. warfarin alone or warfarin combined with aspirin had the lowest rate of death non-fatal reinfarction or thromboembolic stroke. But there was a 3- to 4-fold higher risk of bleeding. So the use of oral anticoagulants today of the vitamin K antagonist type is infrequently addressed, except we may say in patients with a left ventricular thrombus following myocardial infarction, or in patients who have a myocardial infarction as a result of a very ectatic coronary artery system, where stasis of the circulating blood and fibrin deposition are the main pathogenetic factors. And here is the final strategy. The new oral anticoagulants should then be considered in patients with acute coronary syndromes. According to preliminary information, long-term treatment with rivaroxaban at a low dose of 2.5 mg twice daily on top of dual antiplatelet therapy is now an approved option for further prevention of ischemic events after myocardial infarction. In fact, just for the record, the use of low-dose rivaroxaban is beginning to evolve in patients with chronic coronary artery disease, associated or not with a platelet inhibitor, but this is not part of the paper published today in JACC. So I finish section number 2 about the progress in patients following myocardial infarction related exclusively to antithrombotic therapy. 10 different approaches, 3 different syndromes, some associated with intervention, lytic therapy, stenting, some associated with conservative approach. A very complex subject that we tried to summarize in the best way we could. And now quickly, section number 3. What about angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, mineralocorticoid antagonists, and statins following acute coronary syndromes? Based on a number of studies, but specifically the SAVE study, the IRIS study, and the TRACE study, all suggest that the use of angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors can be of great benefit in patients with myocardial infarction who have a decrease in ejection fraction or are in heart failure. The same can be said, although less clear, on the EPHESUS study, in which mineralocorticoid antagonists were actually used in patients following myocardial infarction with a decrease in ejection fraction. Based on these results, treatment with angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibition and eventually mineralocorticoid antagonism is recommended in all patients with heart failure or left ventricular dysfunction following myocardial infarction. And what about the statins? Based in the original 4S study with the use of simvastatin in patients with prior myocardial infarction or angina, the MIRACLE study in patients with early use of atorvastatin following myocardial infarction, the IMPROVE-IT study with the combination in patients of myocardial infarction of simvastatin with acetamiv, and more recently with the use of the PCSK9 inhibitors. Altogether, these studies suggest that in acute coronary syndromes today, we should recommend for early and intense lowering of the LDL cholesterol level, recommendation that should be initiated as soon as possible. So, we have addressed progress in patients following myocardial infarction and on historical basis by 5 different non-antithrombotic approaches, by 10 different antithrombotic approaches, and by the use of angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, mineralocorticoid antagonists, particularly in those patients with low ejection fraction, and certainly with the use of statins and PCSK9 inhibitors, all together had a significant impact just based in a large number of trials in decreasing mortality of patients with myocardial infarction. Section number 4 is addressing the fact that if all of these trials, somewhat selective, really explain a decrease in mortality in the overall population following myocardial infarction. The paper demonstrates that indeed, following the French cross-sectional FAST MI study or registry and the Swedish Heart Registry, the impact in such populations appear to validate the data that has been obtained on the trials. I would only like to add that to the development of technology and the development of antithrombotic agents and other pharmacological agents, an important challenge that we all have is to modify also the so-called behavioral risk factors. Smoking, exercise, appropriate diet, prevent obesity. And so, the non-behavioral ones, hypertension, diabetes, and hypercholesterolemia. Then we should not talk about decreasing mortality in myocardial infarction, but just preventing it. Thank you.